You're listening to episode 6 of The Gearheart. I'm your reader, writer, and host, Alex White. Renee White is the voice of our female characters. If you haven't had a chance yet, or you're listening on iTunes or Podiobooks.com, you can stop by the Gearheart blog and interact at www.thegearheart.com. Or you can email me directly at alex@thegearheart.com. Don't forget that you can also follow us on Twitter, username TheGearheart. And now, settle in, pour a cup of tea, and enjoy as we bring you more tales of the Gearheart. Last time on the Gearheart, Darren's trip back to the Northlands is interrupted by a fearsome prophecy from an old friend, and a lone gunwoman has a sudden encounter with a Queensman. When she learns that she is up against more than she can handle, she decides to join the Seekers. What are the Seeress's plans for this new recruit, and what does Darren's prophecy mean? Find out on the Gearheart. Were hardly quiet, and that was exactly the way Jonathan liked it. The more people were around, the less there was a chance of encounter with whatever was hunting Isabel. All this business of being involved with the Seekers was highly dangerous, and Jonathan wasn't really a fan of adventure. Certainly, he enjoyed a spirited hike or a nice detective novel, but actual honest-to-goodness risk was not in his portfolio of desired activity. The clouds crawled through the sky, burning at the edges with the silver fire of a coastal sunset. Seagulls slid through the air, and as they did, the sun painted an orange coronal upon their heads. Tourist and harbor hound alike mingled in the confined spaces of the docks. The dock workers bustled to and fro, trying to close their business for the evening and get their new cargoes securely into warehouses, while the townspeople browsed newly imported wares. A makeshift bazaar sprung up as each ship docked with its goods, allowing the captains to relieve themselves of some of their stock before paying for storage. The visitors were variegated in personality and profession, ranging from casual day trippers to shady fellows looking to get a duty-free purchase before customs could come around. Jonathan even saw a few nervous-looking boys, no older than 14, scampering through the crowd with tightly clutched wallets and slouch caps pulled far too low for their eyes. Jonathan fondly recalled sneaking out to the Fenwick piers with his friends when he was in grade school, to buy liquor from the foreign crews, who had no knowledge of the drinking customs of the Northlands. It wasn't a law, but Jonathan and his friends could never seem to get anyone to sell them hard liquor when they were young. The initiate jammed his hands into his coat and exhaled a misty breath. Isabel would be in the harbor in a few minutes, and he could stop worrying about her. Or at least, he could stop worrying about everyone collectively once she arrived, which somehow felt comforting. Darren, Augustus, and Keegan were set to arrive soon and escort Isabel to the clubhouse, while Cog remained behind to watch the empty manse for infiltrators. With that much firepower on the docks, and even more at the clubhouse, someone would have to be mad to attack Isabel again. Of course, someone had to be mad in the first place to attack her at a function with two Queensmen in attendance. Unless that person didn't know about the Queensmen. Then again, if that person didn't know about the Queensmen, how could he or she have possibly stood a chance against them? So then that person was crazy. Or powerful. Jonathan made his way down an alley off the main drag and hopped up to sit on a crate, stretching his aching feet. At Keegan's request, Jonathan had patrolled the docks all day looking for suspicious characters, and, being docks, he had found plenty of them. They seemed to grow on the place like moss. It was exhausting to have his guard up all the time, and a stress headache had begun to tunnel into his brow. The initiate closed his eyes and stretched wide, balling up his fists and lifting his legs. He took a deep breath and let the cool ocean air fill his lungs. It looks like you're doing a crack job of keeping the docks safe, Jonathan, came Darren's smooth voice. The air flew from Jonathan's lungs as he nearly tumbled off the crates. He managed to regain his balance, but his heart thundered in his ears. Darren's wardrobe of corduroy slacks and cotton peacoat looked just fine, but there was something ragged about his eyes and beard. His face was poorly kempt, and his eyelids were so sleepless that they were an almost regal shade of purple. The black-haired gentleman still wore his ever-present smile, which was perfect as always. He swaggered forward and shook Jonathan's hand. Glad you could make it back, Darren. Anything interesting happen? I didn't have time to get into anything in Redfield, said Darren. How was the boat ride back? Darren scratched his beard and sniffed. I was stuck below decks the whole time, so it was wonderful. The initiate never really knew what to make of Agent Freeman. Maybe Darren didn't like the light, but Jonathan couldn't be sure. Jonathan looked him over, trying to tell if Darren was being sarcastic, but before he could talk, a burly dock worker rounded the corner. The man was carrying a mostly empty bottle of rum and a crowbar.
Get off the goods, the man slurred. Gotta get in that crate, shove off.
Jonathan looked around, only to find that the alley was not quite as crowded as it was a moment ago. He concentrated on the dock worker, trying to sense anything amiss, but he could only sense that the man was incredibly drunk. Jonathan wondered if it was somehow a trap, and that the dock worker was part of some greater scheme. Jonathan stared at the big fellow more intently, trying to ascertain some deeper intention. Listen, buddy, maybe, Jonathan began, but was cut off as the dock worker launched his bottle into Jonathan's head with surprising speed. The big man took a step forward.
I said clear off, you...
Darren's gun leapt from his shoulder holster before anyone could make another move, and he locked back the hammer. Take another step forward so I can put a hole in you, he warned. The drunken fellow blanched and took off down the alleyway as fast as balance would allow.
That really smarts, said Jonathan.
I should expect so. I don't believe I've ever actually seen a bottle shatter on another man's head. It usually just bounces off, said the bearded man, illustrating the point with his fist and palm.
No, it really smarts that you had to rescue me, Jonathan grunted.
Ah. Darren kicked at a piece of gravel and returned his gun to his holster. You should have been more careful. He was obviously aggressive from the start.
I thought it might have been something related to Isabel, said Jonathan.
What, like a trap?
Well, yeah.
You read too many dime novels, Jonathan. Jonathan stood to brush off his knees, but he was interrupted with a sudden flash of pain across his forehead. He massaged the bridge of his nose, trying to force down whatever monster was trying to escape.
You don't think I'm stupid, right?
I absolutely do. Jonathan's face soured, but then his headache overpowered him. Take it easy, Jonathan. I need you sharp right now, Darren chided. Want me to fix you up?
Nah, I'll power through.
Darren gripped Jonathan's shoulder. Friend, in a fight, we need your skills first.
That's not what Keegan says.
Jonathan squeezed a smile out of his pained visage. I'm fine. I really don't want you going and taking on something you didn't ask for anyway.
It's not about that. It's about combat efficiency.
You don't think I'm efficient now, Darren? Jonathan asked as he eyed the pair of men approaching them from the city side of the docks. Jonathan recognized Augustus first, his gaunt stature and foggy white hair giving him away instantly. Were it not for his frail frame, Augustus would have fit right in with the dock workers, sporting his greasy coveralls and white undershirt. The outfit was crowned by a wrinkled leather bomber that had been worn so thin that it was patched in places. The cuffs looked like they contained more than a few scorched areas between the wrists and elbows. Keegan trailed behind, dressed in his traditional tweed suit, looking far more conspicuous among the dock crowd.
I've seen the way you write papers, Jonathan. Expedient, but not efficient.
What?
Jonathan shook his boots and finished brushing his legs off.
It's true, Augustus added. No one asked you, Sparky.
No need to get defensive, said the pilot.
Keegan looked Jonathan up and down, only to discover a trickle of blood seeping out of the younger man's hairline.
What happened to your head?
Guy hit him with a bottle, Darren interjected. Jonathan was lounging on the man's cargo, and he took umbrage.
Jonathan was now prepared to hear all about priorities and how his were misaligned. Every neuron in the man's brain braced for another impact equal to the trauma they had received moments before. Jonathan's lips pulled into an apprehensive frown as he awaited Keegan's verdict concerning his behavior.
"That's no good," Keegan said. "Darren, fix him up and find a good hiding spot. I don't imagine he'll be too useful after the trade."
The priorities talk would come later, and somehow that was equally bad.
"We'll head out of sight, sir," said Darren.
Jonathan and Darren made their way into a darkened, winding corridor away from the first alley, their eyes darting back and forth. If there were an ambush set for Isabel, it would be bad news to stumble into it ahead of time, whilst perusing for privacy. As they took another turn, between two warehouses and made their way toward the concrete bulkhead, Jonathan mused that they might have found the perfect muster point for a harbor assault. The two men clambered over a small barricade, composed of the skeletons of rotten, discarded crates. Jonathan was particularly careful of splinters, as he always hated digging them out of his soft, pristine hands. Eventually, they came to a fenced-in area, where some of the dockhands stored their various lifting tools under lock and key. Darren stopped just outside the door and peered over Jonathan's shoulder. Jonathan, trying to be helpful, glanced back as well, though neither man saw anyone. Darren reached out and pushed his index and middle finger hard into Jonathan's neck as he pulled out a pocket watch and flipped it open. "Jonathan, before I perform this transference, do you have any medical anomalies or illnesses that I need to know about?" the bearded man asked.
"We've been working together for a year, Darren. You'd know by now, given the number of times that we've done this."
Jonathan tilted his head back to give easier access to his carotid artery, but Darren pushed his head back down.
"Don't do that. Changes the shape of the artery. Your pulse is high."
"I'm embarrassed."
"Is that so? When I trade you, am I going to suffer a stress crash as well, then?"
Jonathan checked the alley again to make sure their situation hadn't changed.
"What?"
"I'm asking if you're scared of me. Tell me the truth, because I'll know in a moment."
Jonathan blinked, nonplussed, but then regained his composure.
"I'm afraid of being okay with all of this, and I don't want to get to the point that I take it for granted. I don't like that Dr. Wilkinson gave me a higher priority than you."
"You're better than me at this sort of thing. You need to be in there."
"I disagree. I've seen you shoot."
"You're too nice for your own good."
With that, Darren traced a small emerald glyph, and the air hummed ever so slightly with power. Of all the other magi in the Seekers, Darren was by far the most exact. His glyphs were precise and beautiful, and it always struck Jonathan how amateurish even the most accomplished magi seemed by comparison. The symbol flared and disappeared as Darren pointed his open palm at Jonathan. Darren curled his fingers, and an almost imperceptible line formed between the two men. Jonathan had never really known what pain was before he joined the Seekers. Certainly, he'd felt it, but as a person, he never really understood it before he met Darren. Jonathan was under the mistaken impression that pain was something that could be given or inflicted, but the reality was so different. As life flowed from Darren back into Jonathan, the young man knew that pain was merely the removal of pleasure. The warmth spreading through Jonathan's body was wonderful, but disturbing. He couldn't relax when, just across from him, a wound festered and opened on Darren's forehead, spilling blood into his eyes. Even as all the pain in Jonathan's frame was replaced with comfort, Darren broke into a cold sweat.
"I'm fine, that's enough," Jonathan urged.
The line of power faded, and Darren blinked, trying to overcome his newfound headache. Within seconds, there was almost no sign of the wound on Darren's visage at all. The only evidence that remained was the cut on his forehead, which the bearded man rapidly stopped with a handkerchief.
"Thanks, Doc. You okay?"
Darren sighed and spat.
"Why didn't you tell me you had heartburn?"
"It's easy to forget that sort of thing."
"Not if you didn't have it before," Darren said, grimacing.
"Seriously, what did you eat, Initiate?"
"Well, there's a little Caldavi shop up on 5th. One meal wouldn't do this."
"Well, they have a really cheap lunch special there, and, Jonathan began.
"Do not eat there any more, or I won't help you when you get shot. This is the last thing I need on a mission."
Darren started to walk, but winced slightly as he put his left foot down.
"Also, clip your toenails more often. The one on your left foot was ingrown."
waters of Fenwick Harbor danced around the Starshine Lady, rolling off her underbelly as it glided past. It was a luxury vessel, and the most popular way for the affluent of Fumiston to get to Cerceval. Certainly there were dirigibles, but the prevailing winds over the waters of the Occidentia made flight a tricky business. There was a decent path along the rift stream, though during certain seasons it could knock a zeppelin clean into the ocean. The seekers of the arcane unknown never risked an agent if they could help it, and so boat travel was the preferred method if none of the organization's hydrofoils could be secured. However, in Isabel's case, she was a born socialite, and the seekers injected her into the upper echelons of society at every turn. As a result, she had an extensive network of contacts, and each new event, like her voyage on the Starshine Lady, rewarded her with more. This time, though, it was a wasted expense. Isabel hadn't been out of her room since embarking. She'd taken all of her meals inside. She was briefed via a hand-delivered telegram, rather than coming to the radio relay to talk to her superiors. The ship's captain had gone to great lengths to get her a seat at his table on the third day, citing that the staff was worried about her health. She declined, and the captain was left with an embarrassing hole in his seating arrangements that evening. The suite where Isabel stayed was ostensibly labeled the clock room, though that was certainly an understatement. Perfectly preserved in smoky resin within the walls were the brilliant brass gears and cogs of the famous Holger Clock Tower, decommissioned 10 years earlier in the Ingigard Archipelago. The national treasure had been partially destroyed in the last war, and the owners of the Starshine Lady were more than happy to come in and pick up the pieces. Now the ornately engraved, hand-cut innards of the clock glistened in the misty brown walls like spirits out of time. It wasn't just the walls that housed the gears, either. The chandelier was crafted from a pendulum orbited by 7 blue topaz crystals. On certain evenings, the crew would ignite the mercury vapor lamp in the top of the ship, and some of that light would be filtered down through a quartz pipe in the ceiling. It would come through a shutter into a refractor that would coat the entire room in pure azure beauty. Under any other circumstances, Isabel would have marveled over her surroundings. She would have spent hours wandering the room, leaving fingerprints all over the perfect polish. She probably would have played with the light shutter, which made a very pleasant clicking sound when activated, until the concierge told her to stop. She would have appreciated the matching duvet and gold lamé drapes. As it stood, she merely sprawled across the oversized bed and tried to remember what Upton's face looked like. It wasn't that she was attracted to him or loved him. She just wanted to see him again, to prove to herself that he existed. She pursed her lips together, shut her eyes, and tried to concentrate. In her mind was a blank slate. Before anything else, his shining blonde hair spun itself into being. It wavered like it did when he laughed that night. His scent, diesel and sandalwood, wafted out of the darkness. Then his shockingly perfect teeth, caressed by his lips in a scoundrel's smile. Then a nose formed from the ether, noble yet long. Then came a set of boots, hanging in suspension. A broken neck. Dead eyes. Isabel shook the picture out of her mind like so many ashes. The other passengers would be on deck right now, impatiently waiting to disembark. They would be waving to folks along the shoreline and the smaller fishing vessels. The crowd would goggle at the massive coal-powered factories dotting the Northlander coast near Fumiston and the thick, silvery smoke belching from their exhaust stacks. Through the windows, Isabel glimpsed the familiar fauna of her home country and was briefly possessed of the urge to go outside and join the fun. Then the boat took a sharp easterly turn, and her side was eclipsed in the shadow of the vessel. As the shadow passed over her room, Isabel rose from her slump. She rolled over the edge of the bed and shakily to her feet. She stumbled over all of her unpacked clothes. She would let the help handle that, and over to the shutter switch. With a clockwork click, she snapped the shutter closed, then walked over and drew the curtains. As the fabric suffocated the last of the light, she once again shut her eyes. If she couldn't find Upton again, she would find the face of the mysterious gentleman in her memories. This time, there was no slow imagining of the texture of hair. There was no slow formation of features or the sampling of wonderful smells. The shadows merely parted, and there he was, smiling his wickedly kind smile. He was reproduced in unerring glory, as though seared into her optic nerve. His pink irises, the color of cherry blossoms in bloom drilled into her own, and she bowed her head instinctively, staring up at the figment. Isabel clenched her jaw and her lips snarled. She wanted to strike him, to try to burn him again. She wanted to spit in his face, but he wasn't there. It wouldn't have mattered anyway. He shook off her best attack with a laugh last time and disappeared into the night before she could fire again. He was a god unto her, and yet the only thing that she wanted to do was to face him again. She wouldn't have come home if Cercival hadn't ordered it. The deck bell rang. They would be disembarking in a few minutes. Slowly, Isabel rose from her bed and began to load the many pistols that she would carry onto the docks. A lone fishing pier extended over the sunset waters like a finger drawing close to a light. A little, man-shaped bump peaked over the top, shoulders hunched, head forward, his hands thrust into his pockets. No one really stood nearby, and he seemed comfortable that way. As the fishers left for the day, they made a conscious effort to move to the other side of the water-washed boards when they passed. The man wore a weathered, wide-brim hat, whose felt had been destroyed in a mangy pattern all over. He removed his withered hand from his pocket and placed it upon the railing of the pier, revealing the tattered sleeves of his frock coat. His ancient boots were encrusted with gray mud and tiny bits of gravel. The man's face was a stern ball of wrinkles, like it had been shattered out of a piece of granite. Tiny, glass-like hairs poked out of his jutting chin, accenting the rifts that ran the path around his pale, cruel lips. His eyes were locked in a hard stare, though his cheek seemed to crawl up over his right eye. His nostrils flared, and his bushy eyebrows twitched, as though flexing the muscles of his forehead. His pale green eyes were fixed upon the warehouses of Fenwick Harbor, over a mile away.
"Mr. Crust!"
called a voice from the shoreline. Crust turned his attention to the large mustachioed man bounding his way down the planks toward him. The newcomer was dressed in an immaculate, buffed calf-skin vest over a rusty red cowboy-cut shirt. He wore a pinstriped town coat over the whole ensemble, topping it off with gem-encrusted golden buttons. The man's bulbous red nose was positively the focus of his face, such to the point that it could overpower the faces of all those around him. Nestled snugly behind his absurdist cephalic appendage were his quartz-on-gold spectacles, whose ornate rims hid his watering gray cow eyes. His plain brown hair was combed into a subtle coiffure over his bald patch on his scalp and secured with pomade, though some of the hairs dripped their way down his forehead in a spit curl.
"Wallaby,"
Crust muttered as the large man drew near.
"Arresting sunset, eh? Whole sky looks like it's on fire."
Crust grunted, his gaze returned to the harbor.
"I'd wager that that's the sunset you'd see every day out in the lowlands." "Tremendous," he bellowed, frightening the remainder of the fishers. "Simply tremendous. Do you know that the cuisine of Redfield is hailed by writers as some of the best in the world? A fusion of native flavors with that of their Caldavian Nordlander conquerors," said Wallaby.
Came Crust, as if to say, "I don't believe you."
"No, sir, no. The best food in the world comes from conquest and suffering. Why, they have this coconut concoction, no idea what the natives call it, that is a heart-stopper, friend, a heart-stopper."
The fat man paused for reaction. The waves slapped the pier supports, and the wind whistled in appreciation of his observations, yet Crust remained statue still.
"It's true. Served in every bleeding restaurant in the place. Coconut chicken thing or something. Can never remember,"
Wallaby continued.
"Have you a point, Wallaby?" Crust grumbled.
Wallaby wrung his sweaty hands.
"Why didn't we poison Darren back before he met up with his friends?"
"I've been observing him longer than you have, Wallaby," someone breathed behind the pair. "The odds were quite against us." Wallaby spun on his heel, stifling surprise, and spotted a middle-aged fellow almost immediately behind him. The man was solidly built, adorned in a minimalist, stormy gray duster over an old white bib shirt. His pinstriped pants were carefully tucked into his amber boots, which carried the perfect sheen of glass. Two pocket watch chains, one of gold and one of silver, crawled around his hips and up to his belt. Round his neck, he sported a silk jacquard tie, knotted with excellent precision. His face, though obviously mature, lacked many of the fissures bestowed by emotion. His hair was a flaxen blonde, close-cropped for efficiency of trim, and matched perfectly by his eyebrows. There wasn't a compassionate or friendly line on his visage, though he was not unattractive. He was simply cold to look upon, and all who met his frosty blue eyes could feel his presence.
"Mr. Buskerton, glad to have you with us," cried Wallaby. "Almost killed you, but it's good nonetheless."
"It's awfully ungentlemanly to question my judgments behind my back, Wallaby."
"Nonsense, scuttlebutt! I don't know what you mean, but Crest has him in his sights."
"Poisoned won't work on that one," Buskerton began.
"No one questions you, dear boy, especially not a venerable, knowledgeable veteran like myself."
"He could have removed any poison from his body, Wallaby," Buskerton continued.
"If that is the answer I must hear, then that is what must be."
"What does that even mean?"
"Mr. Crest, I'm sure you have news," Wallaby coughed.
The old man snorted horribly and spat the result into the murky waters below.
"Didn't want to intrude,"
Crest growled.
"Ah, my good man, but intrusion is your specialty," said Wallaby, clapping his hands together.
Over in the harbor docks, Isabel descended the gangplank of the Starshine Lady in long, graceful strides. Her chest heaved short, frustrated breaths, and her eyebrows were knit together in a less-than-friendly fashion. Her shoulders rolled back, and her head lifted as she saw her friends below. Her expression turned to a tired smile as Jonathan moved forward to greet her. The young man took her luggage from her, set it aside, and they embraced. Crest could see their hearts speed up in the veins of their necks as their bodies touched. A chill wind kicked up off the waters, but Crest didn't blink. He merely pinched the brim of his hat between his thumb and forefinger and brought it down. The line of his scowl lengthened ever so slightly.
"The little girlie is frightened, but angry. She has a strong attachment to that boy in the group Buskerton keeps talking about."
That would be Andrews," Buskerton interjected.
"She's also wearing an awful lot of pistols under all that getup," Crest continued. "It'd be hard to take her out without killing her."
"Oh, heavens no, dear Crest. Leave the thinking to me, old chap," said Wallaby.
"It's true that you wouldn't want to take her here," Buskerton began. "Jonathan Andrews would likely destroy one of us. It would be better to kill her by herself."
"No one is killing her yet. Nicholas spoke to me about this matter and me alone," Wallaby blustered.
All of the remaining fishermen stopped and stared in the direction of the three men, then exchanged glances. The party of spies, in turn, seemed either to not see them or to not care. Two of the men began to pack in their things, trying to act like nothing was wrong. Wallaby finally spoke up as one of the fishermen took a few cautious steps toward the shoreline.
"Look what you've done, Crest. I'm sure all of these fine gentlemen had families," he said, gesturing down the pier. "Now, sadly, they know of our nature."
"I'll take care of it,"
Crest grumbled and shambled off in the direction of the onlookers.
"Who are these new assassins and how will they attack Isabel? What sort of powers could they possess? And does the Seeress know of them as well? How will Jonathan and the others keep their comrades safe? Find out next week on the Gearheart."
This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, visit creativecommons.org.
Today's podcast has been brought to you by Tucker James, Party Man. Tired of having boring parties for you and all your boring friends? Just invite Tucker James to your next soiree and watch the fun explode. For the mere cost of an invite, Tucker will show up at your door on his scooter. And you don't even have to give Tucker any of your beer, because Tucker will bring his own sake or microbrewed beer, which is much better than whatever you're drinking. Now you too can enjoy the thrill of having a debate with a man who wears a fedora and a leather duster to a party. If a pretty girl asks, Tucker will even give you a demonstration of his Aikido. Tucker James, so your parties won't be lame. and by Captain Haverty's Martian Rangers, now recruiting at our station on Olympus Mons. Do you dream of going on a red planet safari and returning home with the head of something weird? Do you really hate the indigenous people and wish there was some way that you could legally oppress them? Join Captain Haverty's Martian Rangers and quit wishing upon a star, because wishing upon things is for sissies. Captain Haverty's Martian Rangers. We're looking for a few good men to replace the last ones.